南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Hello, friends. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you for being here. I hope this video podcast finds you healthy. I really do these days. That's on my mind a lot. So I hope you're all doing well and taking care of one another and safe and secure. We live in very unstable times. Anyway, thank you again for being here. Thank you to my patrons. In all avenues, from Patreon to individual contributions or equipment, every way you support, including watching these videos. Thank you. I guess since I'm at it, like, subscribe, share. Be a bodhisattva. Help somebody else understand. All right. I haven't posted in a few days. And I feel like maybe I need to apologize for creating suspense, if I can say that. But by manner of explanation, I want to let you know what I'm working on. I wrote a book. I assembled a book some 15 or so years ago, and it was an assembly of several essays I'd written in the 5 or so years before it that represent a sorting out and a scholarly attempt by myself to get a hold of all of the things I had learned from my practice so far, all of the things that I had learned that I thought I needed to unlearn and adjust. And that book has been on sale on Lulu and I think through Amazon for, like I said, over 15 years. And I've been rereading it because I've seen where a few of you have purchased a copy. And I'm, quite frankly, I'm very embarrassed by how it reads now. It was something important for me to do at the time. I still had a lot of Nichiren Shoshu in me at the time. I came to this practice through the martial arts and an avid student of Western and Eastern philosophies, from Foucault and Descartes to so on and so forth. I don't need to give you the whole rundown. The bottom line is that I was still finding my personal vernacular for a lot of stuff that I was investigating, learning, teaching myself outside of Nichiren Shoshu, which, by the way, in the organization NSA, was frowned upon quite heavily. And the more they frowned on me for doing that, especially since I had 30 or more people listening to me lead meetings, as we called them, I was always at the headquarters in Santa Monica, talking to, I won't name names, but leadership in California. And I got involved in big projects there. And there was a lot of good to being part of an organization, a group. And I understand the appeal. We all want to feel that way, right? Unfortunately, the politics, the machinations of rhetoric, and too often running into two things were bothering me a lot was the idea that Buddhism was like Aladdin's lamp, and you could, by chanting, you could get stuff. That just annoyed me to no end. And I tolerated it because there were other things that were, as I said, I didn't come to Buddhism completely ignorant. I'd been around Japanese and Chinese martial arts and thinking and people. And there were a lot of things I admired about the discipline and the learning and how you can cultivate your being into something more. That was instilled into me since I was a very young child. So Buddhism presented a door that I hadn't fully investigated. And for whatever reasons, through their large efforts in Southern California to Shakabuku, as they call it, I was introduced to that form of Buddhism. What it did is opened up a lot of doors for me to investigate and to teach myself, as we all do, right? So, longer story shorter, as I was ungluing myself from NSA, and then it started going through its political battles with, because it was the grassroots or the, what do they call it? The lay organization started by Daisaku Ikeda. Well, it turns out it's an extension in North America, Nichiren Shoshu of America, NSA. A lot of people thought I was working for a bottled water concern. I guess there's a bottled water organization by the same initials. Anyway, they were excommunicated from Nichiren Shoshu a couple of times. It was always over ego. You could read through the rhetoric and see that it was a battle for who was more influential. Daisaku Ikeda is a politician in Japan. And so it turns out that he's really using his international organization, the Soka Gakkai International. Hopefully you know what that means. Value-creating society. Well, that's rhetoric he adopts to use as his political identity throughout the world, and certainly in Japan. He runs all the time for Prime Minister of Japan. I think that's the right term. At any rate, all of that aside, there was a lot of rhetoric about, you know, the wish-granting jewel and this odd reverence and worship for Daisaku Ikeda instead of Nichiren. Nichiren's our teacher. We're practicing his doctrine of the Lotus Sutra. We practice Lotus Sutra Buddhism. That's Shakyamuni's Buddhism. We don't practice Nichiren Buddhism. We practice Nichiren's doctrine of Shakyamuni's Lotus Sutra, the ultimate teachings of that Buddha. Nichiren never called himself a Buddha. Nichiren never called himself an inventor of a new breath. His whole life, I just completed a huge series of videos on Nichiren's Gosho's. So you can read every one of his letters that are extant today. I don't think I missed one. And you can see in Nichiren's own words that he's always maintained he was a humble man whose great mission in life and what brought him his stature was simply his message, his clear reforming message of all the Buddhism of his day to Shakyamuni's Lotus Sutra Buddhism. So, yeah, the idea that he's a pre-living Buddha prior to Shakyamuni and all of that rhetoric, it just, all the teachings, the more I learned, the more that sect just fell apart, Nichiren Shoshu. And certainly the organization, SGI, became abhorrent. I couldn't do it anymore. And I was desperately looking for something else that followed the true teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha and Nichiren's modern day scholarship, for he's our teacher, right? And I just couldn't find anything sad. By that time, I had learned enough that I couldn't see an organization or a group that embodied what I was learning from just a simple study and scholarship of the text, both from great religious scholars and schools from the University of Hawaii, Santa Barbara, and several others, as well as research of translations of everything from the early Hinayana texts to the early Mahayana, middle Mahayana. And you could see just from reading the texts and the different translations that the meanings were all very closely grouped and essential to Buddhist practice, far different from the rhetoric you would hear from the organizations. And so I made up in my mind that this is just a rule of mankind, whether it's Buddhism or Catholic or Nabisco or Canon, I've worked at large corporations, they all work the same way. The first priority of organizations is the organization. Make more money, gain more power, more social influence. Oh, and then, oh yeah, the customer. We have to worry about the members, the customers. They're just cogs that help us do our imperatives to grow, to make more money, to get worldwide, to be more powerful. I don't care if it's religion or if it's shoes and boots. That is the goal of every organization. And I was fed up with it. So I started writing down my thoughts on all this stuff. And sometime around 15 years ago, I assembled them into a book called Beyond Zen. You guys have seen me hold it. You've seen me talk about it. As I've brought it up and as a couple of them have sold, I've thought, well, maybe I should reread this thing because it's been a long time. And this is where my embarrassment comes in. I can see thoroughly that even though I was reaching beyond the environment I was in, I was still using some of the rhetoric. My ideas were not fully formed, as certainly as they are now. And I thought, you know, I really owe it to you guys to go back through this and give it a serious once over and clean it up. And so actually you could help me with that. I've been working on that and as humbly as I can working on it to clean it up, to make it make more sense. Not that I don't know how good I am at that, but one of the things that crossed my mind today, two things actually that I want to talk about on this video. And so I'll try not to make it, yeah, we're already 12 minutes into it. I don't want to make this an hour long video. So, first point, I'm rewriting this whole book, Beyond Zen, to reflect with much more clarity what I think I was thinking then, but more importantly, to clarify my thinking now, which is more relevant, on everything I have in that book. So that's the one thing. And I'd like your input on whether or not I should keep the title. Maybe I should just junk the book altogether and call it something else. That can be good. It can be negative. There's a track history to this that I think is kind of fascinating. But, you know, it doesn't really mean anything. I'm not attached to the title. It was clever at the time in the place I was. Because there was a lot of, you know, in Southern California, it's a place of fads, constant fads. And so if you say you're a Buddhist there, more often than not, people will think you're a Zen Buddhist. That's all they know as Buddhism. And I was tired of hearing that because I understand the limitations of Zen. I was a martial artist since I was 2 years old. So I heard a lot of Chan Buddhism, a lot of Nembutsu Buddhism. So all of these terms were very familiar when I started practicing Nichiren doctrine, right? So I had to get these things washed out of my head and clear. So that this book was an assemblage of all those kinds of thoughts. One of the things that was very inculcated into my thinking, and in a way still is, although I think I have a clearer distinction, I don't know. Anyway, to become a master, to be named a master, to be considered a master in any endeavor in the humanities. Not just the martial arts, but other liberal arts, I guess we would call them. In Eastern cultures, is you know, we have a saying in the West, what is it? Practitioner of many, master of none, that kind of thing. This kind of is flip-flopped a bit in the East, and I prefer it. I remember telling somebody, you know, they said that to me, that I was a master of none. And I said, but do many things. And I said, yeah, but I do many things well. Not everything to its utmost, but I do many things well. And to be honest with you, I've never met a true master, certainly in the martial arts, that didn't also excel at several other things. In fact, I later found out through study that you simply aren't known as a master. In other words, that's a position that's given to you by the society at large. It's not something you go, got that last notch, now I'm a master. It's not like in a lot of martial arts practice in the West as a sport, that I've got this belt color, this, but now I've got to get this one, and then I'll be this. You know, that can be blown apart easily by something, I believe, Bruce said, Bruce Lee, that a black belt is simply an accomplishment that says to the class, to the master, that you're now ready to learn a martial art. In other words, beyond the skills, there is the mind-body integration that uses the skills in your particular way that suits your particular body and your way of thinking so that it can be maximized in its efficiency. In other words, minimize engagement with the least amount of harm to yourself and ultimately not having to use it at all. That's a mental battle. You see, learning martial arts that way is a far different thing than the notches on a belt and a sports system of sparring and rules and points and yeah. That's not martial arts. That's just an after-school experiment. You know, in the West, everything has to be turned into a sport, just like judo was after World War II. Judo was an outgrowth of jiu-jitsu, and it's very violent and gruesome. But in order for the Americans to allow Japan to keep practicing their social cultural teachings, there was one man in Japan who basically dumbed it down to be a sport of points with no gouging, none of the end this battle quickly kind of moves that came from jiu-jitsu into judo, do being soft version, soft practice, and brought that to North America through Canada, actually. And then his major student left him later and went to Brazil. That became Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Anyway, I got off my track there. One of the things I talk about in this Beyond Zen is not only Shakyamuni's Buddhism, Bodhisattva Nichiren's present-day teacher for our practice, and of course Lotus Sutra. That's the center of the book. But I also have some chapters dedicated to the development of what I call an excellent being. And I expand the practice of Lotus Sutra Buddhism to include creativity, things like painting, drawing, dance, those kinds of arts. into making a more complete picture for a modern human to not only stay healthy and alert as they practice, as we practice our myoho renge kyo practice, but also that we're modern people and our attention span can be incredibly short. And so that in addition to the practices of chanting and the recitation, I feel like I need to include more of our daily lives, our samsaric existence, with excellence as a part of being in just everyday life. How do we manifest our enlightenment, in other words? How do we, as we awaken our minds, as we sharpen our senses, as we become less attached to every little thing that goes on, the stresses of samsara, we take dance classes or martial arts classes or painting, or we just like, you know, we have our little studio at home where we do our watercolors, or we have a high level of crafts that we take on. I think all of that is closely related to that place, that sense of mind that experiences that bodhisattva flow. I don't think any of us, although we might say it because we're timid, when we do any kind of an art, look, I'm a painter. And, I used to abhor when the press would come for ahead of a show and they'd want to talk about art and how do you see what you're doing and blah, blah, blah. This cliche would come up now and again about, yeah, but ultimately you're an artist. You create art for yourself. Man, I hated hearing that. I said, you know what? That is mysticism in art. This is a persona the artist or the media want to create around an artist to somehow make that what they do more valuable. You know, the art markets there's a lot of scams in the arts. And a lot of it involves creating this false narrative, this false idea. It's like deifying a painter or a sculptor or a boat builder, whatever. And it's disgusting. I know every time that I create something in paint, and look, I'm a figurative artist, so I know with every stroke that somebody's going to be looking at that. So for me to look you straight in the eye and say, no, I just did this for me, come on. I have that image in my head and it changes constantly and I have it every day. That's all I need. Why put it to paint? Why document it? So I can look at and admire my own work? Come on. We all have an audience in mind. We're social creatures. So I don't care if you create little flowers out of, homemade paper and make little compositions. You're making it for others to experience. And you see, I see a real alignment of mind with the bodhisattva in that, is that we're trying to create joy in other people's lives. And I don't see that as completely outside of Buddhism. Yes, I understand. You're never going to reach a late enlightening or awakening from a pretty painting or an ugly painting. It's transformative. It's inspiring. It questions things. It makes your mind go to work. And I think I occasionally have shows here in the school, not only to encourage other people to paint, which I love to do, but also to demonstrate how different people experience the same thing. And I think that's a teaching point, a learning point, if you will, that allows us to consider how we manufacture our opinions about things, which leads to how we're attached to certain ways of thinking or understanding the world we're in, our own experience. So to me, it's a very strong teaching tool, self-teaching as well as other, about the very mechanisms we're wrestling with in our Buddhist practice. So I can kind of actualize the inspiration that I felt and the life condition that I felt this morning after Gangyo, and I can take that into my world, and I can see how I respond to the canvas or an image, how quickly it takes me away from that, or how quickly it takes me to another realm of being, which worlds I inhabit. So it's, so again, it's teaching me about Buddhism, but I'm painting. And when I'm done, I can look at it, and sometimes I'm surprised. Wow, where did that come from? Oh, that was a great accident. I know that came through me too. So what can I learn from a Buddhist perspective about what's going on in this samsaric mind of mine? You know, and how are other people going to respond? Usually completely differently. And that's fascinating. But it's also a shakabuku moment, a shoju moment, I'll call it. Right? Sorry. Yes, I know. Okay. So, did I say everything I wanted to say? So, you know I'm working on the book. You know you can offer me a yay or nay on keeping the title. And the other thing I want to ask you, if you'd be so kind, let me know if you think this discussion of other means of creativity, the excellent being that I talk about in Beyond Zen, is that worthy of more discussion? Should I lean some videos more heavily into maybe even instruction? Or is that just too far afield? Should I just let that go? And believe me, I have no problem letting it go. I started just channel as a bodhisattva effort to help others understand Buddhism clearly without bias, organizational bias or cultural bias, so that we could just practice with joy and excitement. And maybe that's where it should stay. But as I was rereading and rewriting this book, I came across some of that, and I thought, oh, maybe that's something I should just take out of here entirely. Or maybe as a book, you know, it's not a bad validation of other experiences that we have. I'm torn on it so far. So obviously I need to chant more about it, think more about it. But because I really respect you guys as our Sangha, I wouldn't mind having some input on it. And with that, I will let you go on with your day. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to download the podcast. And I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo.